You all know the expression, strangers in a strange land. It wasn't written by Robert Heinlein alone. It comes out of Genesis. And it's a reminder to the Jewish people that even from Genesis, and certainly through modern times, Jews were often strangers in a strange land. Guests sometimes invited, sometimes expelled. In Genesis, the story of Lot welcoming the strangers and washing their feet. It turned out that those strangers were angels, but Lot didn't know it. He only knew that they were strangers. When you turn to the New Testament and the gospel narrative, it's really remarkable. Jesus does all this eating and healing and preaching, and he heals the child of a Roman soldier. He doesn't ask to see identification. He performs miracles, and not once in the Gospels can you find any demand for somebody to show their green parchment. It doesn't happen. In not just Judaism and Christianity, but Buddhism, there is always the sense that the stranger carries the divine. And that the stranger, the beggar, the person whom you do not know, is of equal worth and dignity as you. It's easy to objectify human beings. It's easy to see them as the stranger, to literally put the word strange in stranger. That's where it comes from, in both German, Fremd, and in English, strange. To see the stranger not as the other, but as someone from whom to learn, with whom to bond, to offer humanity and welcome, to see what connects us, is one of the many vital messages that Jews and Christians and Buddhists and Muslims all share together. One of the reasons that any place we go, in almost all of our traditions, we break bread together, is that there is a bond that is formed when we share the miracle of life. I'll talk more about that next week at Easter. But there is a bonding of our common humanity, our common need for bread, for respect, our common need for justice, for truth, for the recognition of our mutual humanity. It doesn't mean that all laws disappear. It doesn't mean anything about chaos, but it means compassion. And I think those are the critical issues that we have if we are going to not simply talk the talk, but walk the walk of looking for truth and justice and peace. This is a kind of unique timing this week, in terms of Passover beginning tomorrow night and Holy Week beginning today with Palm Sunday. They're related not simply sequentially, that the Passover was a time when the Hebrews in Egypt land, in the darkness and the chains of slavery, are reborn into a new life, a new freedom, a new opportunity after passing through the Red Sea and out onto the desert. And that is followed in the Christian narrative by Jesus entering Jerusalem riding a donkey, being welcomed and celebrated, teaching, working, living, seeing what his future was and accepting it, feeling betrayed, ultimately feeling lonely, and feeling despair, and then reconciliation. These are stories that are combined thematically. They're about journeys from darkness to light. Literally, in terms of the Passover story, you can see it as the story of a people. The Hebrews are in slavery, then they are in freedom, then they enter into another phase of their history. But you can also see it as the story of every single, with the exception of cesarean births, almost every single life. We are, most of us, conceived in darkness, sometimes with Johnny Mathis in the background, sometimes not. We are born, and it's interesting that the Red Sea parting, in the Hebrew it's called Mitzrayim, and it is a squeezed place. To go from the dark to the light through a wet canal did not have to wait 3,000 years for Freud. They understood it was a birth story. And what did they do when they had their life out there on the desert? They were taken care of. They were fed with manna from heaven, just as children are fed by their parents. Manna, incidentally, does not mean breadfruit. Manna is Hebrew for what is it? That's literally true. I'm not making this up. It means what? So did they enjoy it? No, they looked at it and says, "You, great God of all history and the universe, this is the best you could do? You call this a meal?" And it didn't become a meal until they grew old enough and wise enough to accept the law. And then it was flavored with cinnamon, with honey, and with cardamom, and became sweet. The Hebrews did what an individual child does, rebels against authority. Moses, daddy, goes away for 40 days. And what do? They put down a street sign down on the boulevard and say, "Party going on here." They started to have a party. They melted down gold. They built an idol. They, in the words of Dizzy Dean, backslid to a pagan religion. And they rebelled. And then daddy came home and read them the law. And they finally got it. They paired up. They had their own families. They came to another river, a river that they couldn't cross, but their children could. It's the story of human beings who are born, who are taken care of with any luck at all, who rebel against their caretakers, eventually find themselves, eventually, hopefully, grow up, have their own families that they nurture and take care of until they come to that river, the Jordan River, the river of the future that they can't cross, but their children can. And all the work and all the life and all the struggle is worthwhile because it advances their story and their children. When you look at the final week of Jesus' life, the beginning in Palm Sunday, you see him also the story of an individual, and almost every individual who, if you see entering Jerusalem with great hosannas and celebrations, is like a birth story. There's great joy when he enters Jerusalem, and he gets to live his life and be with his friends and teach and preach, and then he gets this sense of foreboding and understanding that the party will end, that his friends, who he loves dearly, will betray him, either actively as Judas or passively as Peter, and yet he continues. And he has moments of despair where he cries out, as David the psalmist did in the 22nd Psalm, "Father, Father, why hast thou abandoned me?" One of the great questions of faith that I think people get wrong so often is they think of faith as something that is constant. But if you read scriptures, you see that faith is always up and down. It's always being tested. The psalmist is going, "Life is wonderful. It's beautiful out there. Everything's going great." And the psalmist is saying, "Oy, why hast thou forsaken me? My friends are prospering and I'm doing terribly." And even Jesus, the penultimate words on the cross, "Father, Father, why hast thou forsaken me?" And then acceptance. "Into thy hands I commend my spirit. This week is the story of life compressed. There's so much that's shared in common. Not simply the numerology, that you have the 12 sons of Jacob and the 12 tribes of Israel and the 12 apostles, but images that who sells out Joseph? Joseph is sold into a pit, and he rises from that pit to save his people. He arises at the side of Pharaoh the king and delivers and saves his people. What brother sells him? Yes, it's Judah. Jesus is sold by Judas, same name, only the Latin ending. And he is sold into a pit and then arises from that pit to save his people. The stories have so many similarities, and they're not accidental. They are repeated themes about the human experience, about how we live, how we suffer, how we despair, how we can fall into a despondency that seems overpowering. But one of the great stories to me in the whole gospel narrative is the story of Peter. Peter promises to be true. He promises to be faithful. And when he is tested on that ultimate day, he denies that he knows Jesus. He says, him, the bearded guy, never seen him before. Some hippie dude, I don't know. I'm not with him. And yet, instead of completing the betrayal, as Judas does, by killing himself and ending the possibility of redemption, of tshuva, of returning to his values, he does rise out of the pit of despair. And he does become, eventually, the rock upon which the church is built. It seems to me that these messages from the psalmist, as well as from Jesus, as well as the story of Peter, are acknowledgments of the fact that our dreams may sometimes seem to die. The forces of fate, of oppression, of fear, of despondency can push us into not wanting to engage, not believing in the springtime. But the Passover and the Easter forbid us from living in despair. Of course you experience reversals. Of course there are times when you feel like the world is just too big to engage. That's normal. That's modeled by every great biblical story. And what is also modeled is the belief in the spring, the belief in the turning of the seasons, the belief that spiritual resurrection is open to all of us as long as we live, that there are opportunities to engage our dreams and our hopes. It is not just Joseph who is the great dreamer. They're all dreamers. We are all dreamers. And the job of the truly religious is not to talk about our beliefs. It's not simply to say, I have a dream. It is to make our dreams come true by living our values. Faith is really not just the joke that I made earlier about belief in things unseen, except the thing unseen is the strength of heart and will that we human beings can tap into. Our real faith is faithfulness to our deepest values, our deepest hopes, and making commitments to work assiduously to give them the flesh of real life. Christians, Muslims, Jews, Buddhists, agnostics, atheists are all called to engage in a valuable life of leading and living and modeling our values Not perfectly. No one does. Just remember in the Christian message, Jesus cries out, "I feel abandoned, God, you have deserted me." There are none of us perfect in our engagement with the world. But we are called to engage it nonetheless. When we are weak, we look to each other for a hand. When we are frightened, we look to each other for arms and embrace. When we are strong, we offer our hands and our hearts and our embrace to each other, to life, and to the spring.